brief. It's Friday, the 17th of September, 71, Channel 1 Right. This is the beginning of the new telephone tape this Friday, the 17th of September, 71, Channel 1 Right. Channel 1 Right, and beginning of a new telephone tape this Friday, the 17th of September, 71. It's the beginning of a new telephone tape this Friday, the 17th of September, 71. Channel 1 Right. Channel 1 Right, beginning of a new telephone tape this Friday, the 17th of September, 71.
Hartley, NBC News, report and commentary.
The military draft is making its comeback in the Senate. I will be back in a minute. The Senate today voted not to kill the draft. The vote was 47 to 36. The voting was on a motion to table the bill, which is a way of sending it into oblivion. But the draft bill lives. The Senate still has to pass it, and there will probably be a filibuster before it does. But the likelihood is that young Americans will again be receiving their induction notices. They have not since June 30th, when the old draft bill expired. The controversy over the draft bill has not been just over the draft itself, but also over efforts led by Senator Mike Mansfield to attach an amendment setting a definite date for American troop withdrawal from South Vietnam. That is something President Nixon has had to fight repeatedly in the Senate. He has won again this time. But no one, neither the President, Congress, nor the Army, has yet solved the longer-range problem of how to get the necessary manpower for the armed forces. This is a problem which will continue long after a draft bill has been passed. There are two schools of thought on this. One says there is no fair way to ask young men to die for their country, that therefore the draft, although not perfect, is the best way to make sure that the burden of sacrifice is shared equally. Others point to inequities in the draft and morale problems of draftees in the Army and say what the country needs is an all-volunteer Army. This is what President Nixon has been saying and aiming at. His theory is that once the burden of Vietnam has passed, an Army which offers more attractive pay and working conditions can attract enough volunteers, so the draft will no longer be necessary and no longer a political issue. It's a nice theory. It would be nice for a young man not to have to worry about having his life interrupted by the draft. It would also be nice to know that we have an army of volunteers, which, because they are volunteers, would be highly motivated. Army leaders, worried by the slipping morale in the ranks, would like it too. Experience, though, has shown that a volunteer army means a small army. It is difficult to attract large numbers of qualified and highly motivated people. Two examples of this. Britain has a volunteer army and has been able to do without the draft only by keeping its army small and reducing its presence around the world. West Germany has a large army with a very unmilitary atmosphere, a pleasant place to work. But even with a draft, the German army is desperately short of technical people and non-commissioned officers. The point is that a large army cannot be a volunteer army. Even though the American army of the 70s will not be as large as the army in the 60s, it still must be large enough to carry out the role of a great power, and you just are not going to get enough men from volunteers. Despite the new, mod, with-it image the army is trying to create for itself, few young Americans who have lived through the Vietnam years are attracted to the military life. So like it or not, good or bad, the draft seems to be the only answer. Garrick Utley, NBC News, New York.
Berger says the courts cannot reform American society. A lot of young lawyers think they can. Well, whether or not they can, it is not certain they ought to. Back in Chief Justice Berger says Americans should not expect the courts to reform society, as a lot of lawyers, particularly younger ones, now do expect. He says they think they see the alluring prospect that the world can be reformed in the courts, because federal judges don't have to get elected or worry about voters, and so are free to concentrate on public problems without regard for public opinion. Berger said it may be an interesting idea, but it won't work, because, he said, the courts simply are not equipped to deal with social problems effectively. That they should be dealt with by Congress and the other legislatures and by the people themselves. Well, these views are distasteful to a lot of young lawyers who feel the courts are the way to social reform and who look forward to having a hand themselves in bringing it about. And on this score, some have criticized Berger. Well, regardless of what should be or shouldn't, the recent history of the Supreme Court does not support Berger's argument, because in the last 20 years or so, it has led or dragged the American people into enormous social change. Integrating the schools is only the most obvious change, and this was done in the courts, not in Congress. It was the court, not Congress or the people, who ordered state legislatures to redistrict. It was the court that upheld busing. It was not Congress and not the people, and so on down a very long list. In doing all this, the federal courts have become one more vast center of power, as they never were before in all of American history. One more center of power in a country that may very well already have too many. In a country that was from the beginning suspicious and fearful of concentrated power, and wrote the Constitution to try to avoid it. They believed then, with Lord Acton, that power corrupts, and there is nothing in modern America to suggest they were wrong. So it is curious that the liberal view supported the Supreme Court because it was using its power to make liberal decisions. But once an institution has seized power, there is no assurance its decisions will always be so liberal. Those who supported the court's tremendous power when they liked the decisions, what would they say about its power in the future if they did not like its decisions? It is not hard to guess. Labor unions got great power in the 1930s to make social reforms. Well, now, in the 1970s, they still have the power, but now they often abuse it. Social reform that way has a high price. David Brinkley, NBC News, Washington.
Hello?
Hello, Guy?
Yeah.
Hi, has Faye left yet?
She just left. Oh, not just. She's been gone 15, 20 minutes.
Okay, I just wondered. Mr. Weaver's taking Gemini fox hunting tomorrow morning.
Oh, don't tell me.
Yeah.
Well, what about it?
I went by there, you know, because he'd been talking about doing it. And
yeah. There's
no way to call him, you know. So he said, yeah, he's going in the morning.
Well, what about
for
it?
For us to come.
Isn't that marvelous? Oh, that's just marvelous.
Well, I just want to check, because that little, down, the little girl is over here.
Over to her house?
Uh-huh.
Well, she's going by Phyllis, by Helsum's, you know.
Oh.
You might catch her over there.
Okay.
Right.
All right, thank you.
We've had just constant company since Mother left last Sunday.
Uh-huh.
I'd never believed in my life I'd have so much. I don't know where it came from.
Well, this week seems like a month to me. I said I felt like a neglected stepchild.
Well, me too. They got off Sunday, you know. It seems a year ago.
Yeah, that's what I said.
I just don't know what happened.
Are the children here, or you just have some other company?
I just had, I've had students. I've had people from town out. We had one friend came up from Miami the day Friday before Mother, Saturday before Mother, and before they left, and just left last night.
Well, I declare, I appreciate it all. Can't even think now. I've been through it. Coming to see me.
Oh, yeah.
I can't. They just left me.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, we just I passed by there two or three times with these youngsters in the car.
Uh-huh.
And then I've been in town several times this week because I have to get things started and schedules made, and you know I put that off just as long as I can.
I thought maybe you had started teaching again.
And with that plus all my company.
You just had it. Had,
yeah.
And I didn't know whether you knew about Jolene.
No, I don't.
Well, she's not seriously injured, but she was. It gave us a scare of her life and almost wrecked Max and Alice. She was he was letting them ride on the back of the tractor yesterday morning, and he was more in the yard. And had some other attachment on, and there was a place that they could ride.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted to get off until he stopped, so he stopped to back up, and she thought it was time to get off.
Uh-oh.
And she got under the mower, and she got under the left side, and he got her out on the right side. He had to lift the mower up on her.
Oh.
He didn't know what he was going to find when he lifted it up.
Oh.
It was one who didn't have a heart attack.
Mm.
But she was just injured on the right knee.
Oh,
as far
thank
as
goodness.
You know. And they got her right on into emergency. And Dr. Brill was serving for Dr. Dale. And Alice said, we'd like you to get hold of Dr. Kassam if possible. And he was there by the time they got the x-rays.
Oh.
And he said, when he looked at that phrase, he said, I don't think you have much to fear. But he got into surgery.
Uh-huh.
And they had to get skeleton crew so he could do surgery. And he didn't have to put the pins in. And it was just a little sliver off of one of the small bones.
Oh, Flora.
She's in the hospital there. They had a room with the two beds, so she and Alice staying with her. And now Dr. Kassam said last night that if she had a good night, that she could come home today. She's in a splint, her leg is.
Uh-huh.
But she was pretty restless, and they had to give her shots for pain. And so today she's running a little temperature, but he started on an antibiotic to hold down infection.
Sure.
So they had the godparents. The children were to come last night for the night, so they got there, and I said, it was just intended, I think, for you all to be coming, you know, at this time, because Sarah just went ahead and helped Max get supper, and they took Alice her supper, and they came home and ate, and then Sarah got breakfast, and they were here for dinner, and they went on to Daytona Beach, so Max spent most of the afternoon at the hospital, and then he came back, and got little Mark tonight, so I'll get Mark in the morning, and we hope she'll get along. But they won't bring her home as long as she runs temperature.
No, but my goodness,
poor Max hadn't been able to eat hardly, you know.
Well, yes.
Both of them were just, I don't
just
see
thinking.
How he drove to Gainesville, really, you know.
Uh-huh, just think, you know, just the shock of what could have happened,
oh,
and
yeah,
then how to be.
He said, well, that accident now would happen again.
Yeah. And they happened so fast.
I know, it's warning. And they had an automobile wreck down between you and McIntyre tonight, and Dr. Strange and Ms. Strange were in one car, and the doctor from Gainesville was in another, and I don't know how it happened, but anyway, the Strangers had carried a maid home. Coming back, so I don't know whether they were out on the highway or whether they came out or whether they slid, you know,
uh-huh.
You just don't know. But said the doctor from Gainesville thought he was seriously injured. We heard
and
that.
Who is he?
We don't know.
Oh, how about the Strangers?
Well, they, Nancy's maid has high blood pressure. She saw the wreck, and she just got so upset that she came by and told Nancy and them about it. Said Dr. Strange looked like he had a hole in his head, and they were, and some of the niggas had towels out and were working on him.
Oh, my
him,
goodness.
You know.
My Flora?
But Ms. Rutland said that she understood that someone from McIntyre should carry the Strange's home, and that they had cleaned up, and that the Wilsons at the drugstore had driven them to the hospital at Ocala.
Oh, yes.
So the doctor from Gainesville was carried on to Gainesville. So I'm anxious to know who that is. I think some of those men played golf down at Ocala. I've seen Billy Thomas down there.
Yeah.
The new place. So
yeah.
I just hope it weren't hurt seriously. You know, sometimes it looks bad and it isn't.
Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't look so bad and it's real bad. So you just don't know.
Goodness.
Well, I just wanted to
well,
if you were all right,
well,
you heard from the folks, hadn't you?
Yes, I've had a letter from Mother since they got back. They made the trip fine. We had they of course, on when they leave on Sunday, they always get off early.
Well, you have to make it one
yeah,
day.
Yeah, well, I mean, not
Lynn,
the dawn,
I think,
but it just...
Lynn's name, while ago, but he said he had to go back to work, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I appreciate him coming to see me.
Well, he thinks you're part of the family. And I'm just so, goodness, I'm sitting here with goose pimples about Jolynn.
Oh, I see.
But I'm just, it's just miraculous, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it's just a blessing and just... That's
just
so much for which to be grateful.
I should say, my goodness.
Never know what. I said, if you rear family without any injuries, you've done something, you know.
Yeah, and as careful as they are, and as everybody is, but I tell you, those mowers. You know, this guy, you know, the guy with his finger, and he just was sure he was being careful.
Yeah, well,
but they are really
a finger too, you know. And so you just,
that's right.
Well, you can fall in the bathtub. You can somebody can hit you. Honest, the way these automobiles are made, it's a wonder we all don't catch it.
I know it. I just think it'd be nice if we could just be where we didn't have to ride everywhere we went.
Well, we might stop out on this. Well, come by when you can.
I will, Flora. Thank you.
I'm feeling all right.
Yes. And I'll tell you, it just, you know, what saved our whole time over here was that cake. It was the best thing.
Well,
all Flora and Mother said nobody but Flora would ever think of it,
I didn't get over to Daisy's until I was going in to see Dr. Foot Junior Perry's with Dr. Garland.
Oh.
And Lois had been up, and we've known the Foot family for years. And Lois went up with her ear.
Uh-huh.
She didn't get the satisfaction from Dr. Bitzlin, so she went to Dr. Garlinson's office one morning. She said, well, I'm suffering, so I don't have an appointment. No one sent me, but I'm suffering. I'm going to stay here until I can see Dr. Garlinson.
Uh-huh.
And the nurse said, well, he's in surgery now, but Dr. Foot will see you.
Uh-huh.
And Lois had known Perry. He had spoken down to Presbyterian Church several times when he was real young. And so he took her, and he got some relief.
Well,
and so she told me, so I decided I'd go in, so I made an appointment. So I went in Friday afternoon to see him, but he didn't find anything wrong with my vocal cords or my windpipe or anything.
Well.
So I haven't. And I went by Daisy's to carry some food. And she said, Doris said, Miss Flora, you must not know that Daddy had died. Ben had died, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, Daisy, I didn't know he was sick till he was almost dead. And then I didn't know he was dead for several days. And I said, I just haven't gotten here. So I went by Thursday, Friday afternoon. So I was glad I did because I wouldn't have gotten there yesterday.
Yeah.
Max and them called
her. Yeah.
When she went to surgery, they came back home hurriedly to change the clothes. Alice was just bloody all over.
Sure.
She hadn't even gotten a towel, I don't think.
Uh-huh.
Well, tell Guy hello for her.
I will, Floyd. Thank you for calling. Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen when the present wage price freeze ends on the 13th of November? But there are a couple of things we can guess at. One is that the lid is not likely to come off entirely. The president gained the approval of an overwhelming majority of the people when he enacted the freeze. And despite the fact that this support will decline in the months ahead, as people get mad at the freeze when it hurts them, there is still a general feeling that some restraint, some control, some means of stabilization is absolutely necessary. The president himself has said that, and last week he said phase two of the freeze will be a tough program of selective wage and price restraints, a program with teeth in it for enforcement. So the question is, who is to be restrained and who is to be let free? I'll have some facts and figures on that in a minute. Two of the wage price freeze begins in the middle of November, and the administration is now working on a plan which will keep some wages and prices in the freezer while allowing others to thaw out. This is a tricky exercise, since some people are going to be offended no matter what, and everybody is going to be offended if something isn't done about inflation and unemployment. It looked for a while as though the administration might be picking the pocket of John Kenneth Galbraith, the Harvard economist, who has proposed that controls be put on only the very largest companies and unions. Galbraith's theory is that almost all of the pressure for inflation comes from the giants in industry and labor.
He argues that the guy who runs the hardware store or the gas station doesn't have a great effect on inflation, and neither does the guy who works in the hardware store or the gas station. The really big ones, steel, autos, steel workers, auto workers, are easy to control, and they're perhaps the villains. So goes this argument. They could be controlled by a small bureaucracy, which would please Mr. Nixon, who hates large bureaucracies. But there is an alternate point of view. That point of view says that while the price of commodities, such as automobiles or appliances, has gone up by 26% in the last dozen years, the price of services, hospitals, house painting, auto repairs, things like that, has gone up twice as much as commodities, 55% in a dozen years. The Washington Post published some of these figures this weekend. What they seem to indicate is that while there is only one General Motors involved in the inflationary cycle, there are an awful lot of garages and beauty shops and doctor's offices, and they make a major contribution to inflation as well. The point being that it is one thing to control the big fish in industry and labor. That can be done with a small control group. But to control and police the millions of service facilities, to check on the wages and prices of the little fish would require an enormous bureaucracy, and even that might not work, which is why figuring out what happens in phase two is such a tricky exercise. John Chancellor, NBC News, Washington.
Volunteer Army in about 2 years, but in looking at the volunteers it is getting now, who are mostly not very smart, the Army is dubious. Back in it. A volunteer Army would be nice, if only because it would mean everybody in uniform would be there because he wanted to be, because he chose to be, not because he was forced into it by law. A volunteer Army would be composed of professionals in a career they freely chose, instead of members of what amounts to a press gang. President Nixon wants a volunteer Army within about 2 years, and is pursuing some policies meant to bring it about, including another raise in the military pay. So it sounds fine, but the truth is it's not as good as it sounds, and for several reasons. Here's one. Even though we've had the draft for several years, the Army still gets a fair number of what it calls true volunteers. A true volunteer is one who joined without being drafted and without being threatened with the draft. People who, for one reason or another, would not have been drafted and signed up simply because they wanted to. Well, the Army reports now that most of these true volunteers are not very bright. In tests, only about 18% scored in the higher levels of intelligence. That means 82% scored toward the bottom and 33% at the bottom. Well, there are some disputes about the validity of intelligence testing, and they're not perfect, but they do tell something. Actually, they tell a great deal. And what they tell the Army is that its true volunteers are mostly just not smart enough to do what it needs to be done. The military life is more demanding now than it used to be. The Army has a lot of complicated weapons and radar and so on that require at least a reasonable intelligence, and that kind of volunteer it is not getting. And even when they raise the pay again, the Army figures it still won't get them, because these days the public's opinion of the military life as a career is simply not very high, and lowest of all among the brighter young men the Army needs. So the evidence is an all-volunteer Army would not be a very good Army, because it likely would get mainly the least educated and the least intelligent elements of society. And of course they don't need platoons of geniuses, but they do need men a little smarter than that, and they're not getting them. Still another argument against a volunteer Army is that it could produce a military caste separate and isolated from civilian society, out of touch because no civilians ever go into it. The history in other countries of armies like that is not attractive. Again, Mr. Nixon wants an all-volunteer Army by 1973, and it sounds nice. But will it work? The Army doubts it. David Brinkley, NBC News, Washington.
He hasn't?
Well, he was killed.
Oh, Miss Nick. You mean James?
James.
What happened?
He was shot.
Miss Mary.
And I don't know what happened.
I couldn't tell you. I was homesick, and I don't know what happened, but he was shot.
Why, Miss Mary?
He was at the funeral yesterday evening.
Well, when did it happen?
I can't hear you.
I say, when did it happen?
There's been so many tales about it. We got a phone call at 4 o'clock Saturday morning. And I heard yesterday at the funeral that he was killed about 1 o'clock Friday night. So I don't know.
Well, I sure am sorry. And
really?
We didn't know anything about it. We would have been over there to see you.
I thought maybe you might have seen it in the paper. Of course, the paper didn't say he was killed, said he died.
Oh, I see. Well, no wonder you've been up all night.
Well, I was sick Friday night, and I was up all night Friday night, and took me some pain medicine and got my heating pad and made me some coffee and just got off to sleep about 4 o'clock when the telephone rang, and I thought maybe it was Aunt Nora. Something had happened to her, and Marvin come in and answered it, and it was that old thing that he lives with that called Marvin and said he'd been killed.
That was
they're still investigating it.
And she called at 4 o'clock.
She did at 4 o'clock Saturday morning.
Just when you had got about ready to go to sleep.
That's right.
Well, I didn't know that, that woman was still with him.
Well, I didn't either. She was supposed to be gone. You know, she had left him. And he called me Wednesday. And he told me he had to go to court. And I said, what you got to go to court for? And he said she had sued him for divorce, for the place, for alimony, and his insurance. But I heard yesterday that the judge had put the case off, and she told Marvin that she moved in there Thursday night and Friday night. She had moved back. And some said he was shot with a shotgun, and some said he was shot with a rifle. He was shot on the right-hand side of his head in the temple.
And James didn't have anything to say about her coming back, I guess.
Well, I couldn't tell you. When I talked to him? You mean Wednesday?
Yeah.
No, he didn't. He said he hoped he'd keep her going and never come back. And I shamed him about him fighting. And he said, Mama, he said, supposing you was in the shape I was in, and Marvin would walk up and kick you on your sore leg. And said, oh, he told me, well, it's all over now. He's gone.
Did you know that such things like that were happening?
Did I know?
Uh-huh.
No, I didn't until he told me Wednesday. But I knew she treated him bad, and you know, while she was gone, I called over there one day. Of course, I was concerned about him, and to find out how he was, and she answered the telephone, and she naturally bawled me out. And I said, well, Rosie, I ain't done nothing to you nor to James, and I tried to stay out of your troubles and squabbles. And I was in the hopes you all would patch things up and make a go of it. And I've towed down the receiver.
You mean she bawled you out?
Oh, yeah, she bawled me out and cuss James out because I didn't have him and wait on him like I should have. And I said, Rosie, James is a grown man. He's got a family and a wife. And I can't just go over there and demand him to come and live with me. I ain't never said nothing to her to hurt her feelings, and I ain't never done nothing, but she just a mean woman.
Well, you never crossed her. You never crossed her. You never argued with her.
Not a bit. Not a bit. I didn't argue with her. I didn't argue with her one bit. I just taken all I could off of her, and I never did get to talk to James. But James did call me Wednesday, and I told him, I said, now, James, your business is your business. I said, son, for goodness sakes. I said, this is a mother's advice. I said, if you and Rose go back together, that's fine. But I said, try to live right and don't fuss and fight with her. And if you can't live with her without fussing and fighting, go your merry way.
But she wouldn't let him do that.
Just wouldn't let him do it. And he told me, he said, Mama, the whole trouble is my insurance. Said ever since I got out of the hospital, she's been wanting to get it all in a lump sum. And said, I fought it. Said, if I get my insurance in a lump sum, she'll spend it and throw it away, and I won't have a thing in the world to live on.
Well, how would that work out with the insurance?
Well, some says they'll pay it and some says they won't, so I don't know. I guess she'll get a... I don't know, Miss Miles.
Oh.
But I will say one thing. I'm thankful it was him that went. I'm glad my boy didn't kill nobody. I'm glad that's not on his fingers.
Yes. But James wasn't mean. James wasn't mean.
Do we?
Your boy wasn't mean. He wasn't a mean boy. Your boy.
Well, not that I know of. Everybody said, and I asked Mr. Hayes, the undertaker, I said, he wouldn't talk to me about it. He wouldn't tell me a thing, but he took Marvin off and told him where he was shot, and he said, Marvin, it looks peculiar to me.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I'm afraid that insurance is the whole cause of it. Money, money, money. The root of all evil.
Well, now, you just can't sit over there and think about this, Miss Mary. What you going to do? You just can't sit there by yourself and think of it.
Well, I'll have to thrash it out somehow or another.
Has Marvin gone to work?
Yeah, he had to go today or lose his job. He can't stay off too long. And I got to go over to Mrs. Geiger sometime this morning and take her hat that she let me have to wear to the funeral.
Oh, I didn't hear you.
Ma'am?
I didn't hear what you said.
I can't understand.
I said, you have to go where?
To Mrs. Geiger's. Just across the railroad.
Oh, and...
Geiger's.
I see. To take a hat?
To take a hat that she let me have to wear to the funeral yesterday.
Oh. You mean James's funeral?
James's funeral?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I guess you haven't. I guess you haven't finished your hay,
ma'am.
You haven't finished your hay.
No, ma'am. We've got 400 bales gathered, and we haven't cut any since. We were gonna cut some last Saturday, but this come up, and we didn't get to cut. But we did intend to cut Saturday.
Well, maybe it's lucky. It's been raining over here.
Well, it rained over here yesterday. How's Mr. Geiger?
He's all right.
I mean, Mr. Miles.
He's all right. He's.
Well, I'll let you go, and y'all come to see us.
Well, Miss, we'd love to see you, and we will see you.
Okay.
And
come over any time. Bye-bye.
I got your note.
Oh, you did?
I wanted to tell you earlier than this that Mr. Brown had a key and we got in.
Oh, that.
And we had a lovely, restful weekend.
Well, then I don't feel so bad about it.
Well, you shouldn't. Don't feel at all bad. And Herman has written to Don. And we're just as grateful to him and to you as we can possibly be.
Well, you...
Because of your efforts in trying to find...
you're sweet to call and thought about you all weekend, that this was something I could do for you and wasn't able to.
No, indeed, you've done so much for us, and we do appreciate it immensely. And I was just embarrassed that I put you to all that time.
No, as I wrote...
...had in the world, but I just thought... I had heard you say you had one, and I thought...
Well, you know, I just thought I...
Put your hands on
it. Was just a matter of just going to that box and getting it. And I'm sure I gave it to... I gave them to Faye.
Yes, that must be true.
Tell me, have they brought Alton home?
Yes, they took him home last Thursday.
Last Thursday?
Yes. And the floor on which he was staying had become so terribly noisy with very ill people.
Oh.
There was one man who'd been brought in the day before who just screamed all night.
Oh, my goodness.
I've forgotten what his problem was, but he was very ill. And Alton didn't get any rest for a couple of nights and days. And the doctor says, well, tell you the truth, you'd be much better off at home.
Well.
And so he sent him home.
I think that's remarkable.
Yes, and he's weak. He's doing nothing but lying down.
Uh-huh.
And just taking just those steps that he has to take.
Oh, but he can get up a little.
Yes, he can. He goes to the bath. And,
uh-huh.
And I don't know how much sitting up he does, but I do know that Hazel says that he can take a few steps and that he's improving every day. She called this morning and said that she could see an improvement even over yesterday.
That's marvelous.
Yes, it certainly is.
It really is. Well,
I hope you and Guy are all right.
We just got in. They walked in the door from town.
Oh, I see.
And we're just fine.
Well, good.
And want to see you.
And all right. And same here.
And thank you.
And we will as soon as possible.
All right.
And thank you so much for your sweet note and for your effort.
Well,
I know that it would have produced it if it could have.
But you just have no idea how cleaned out everything is.
Well, good. I have that to do now and then myself. I know what you mean.
Nothing like a good excuse.
Yes, indeed.
And thank you.
Well, it's been nice chatting with you, and you start to work very soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, I've already started.
Oh, you have?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that's why I was made to reach
you. I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I was in town.
Well, we'll get in touch with you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Garrick Utley.
Along the Champs-Élysées here in Paris, the leaves are starting to turn. The hot pants are disappearing, and women are starting to wear very feminine-looking dresses. It's a nice time to be in Paris, even if only for a day. I am in Europe this week on assignment, one day in Paris and the rest of the week in Germany. That division of time pretty well sums up the new balance of political importance in Western Europe. In Germany, I will be watching the annual maneuvers of the German army, the largest in Western Europe. Its size and its role is only one indication of the weight the government of Chancellor Willy Brandt now carries among his fellow European leaders. An extremely important event, which received only slight attention in the United States, but has caused great debate in Europe, was the meeting last week between Chancellor Brandt and Soviet Party leader Leonid Brezhnev. Brandt flew to see Brezhnev along the Black Sea. It was the first time a West German chancellor visited the Soviet Union. The two leaders swam, joked, and talked a lot. When it was all over, Pravda ran a front-page editorial calling the meeting a contribution to European security, and leaders of other Western countries tried to figure out what the new German initiative means. What it means, as Chancellor Brandt indicated last week, is that West Germany is an emancipated country, and it is going to conduct its own foreign policy. Brandt started it all 2 years ago with his Ostpolitik, his new policy to the East. He has carried out negotiations with Russia, Poland, and seeks agreements with other communist countries. He also worked actively for the Big Four Agreement on Berlin signed earlier this month. At every step, Brandt has been careful to consult with his Western allies, especially the United States, Britain, and France. They have given their support, but sometimes grudgingly. This is most clear here in France. The French would like to play the role of a major political power in Europe. Charles de Gaulle, in fact, started in the early 1960s to make France the mediator in détente between Russia and the West. But the Russians didn't take France seriously. They do take the Germans seriously, partly because of West Germany's economic strength and partly because of Germany's geographic location in the heart of Europe. So the Germans have usurped the role the French wanted as the détente makers in Europe, and French papers, following the Brandt-Brezhnev meeting, have been dropping hints that Germany shouldn't go too far and that France still has an allied role in Berlin and that, who knows, France might one day choose to recognize communist East Germany. But these threats don't carry the weight they once did. They are more an indication of irritation here that it is the Germans, the aggressors in the last two world wars, who are getting the attention and the credit as the new peacemakers of Europe. Garrick Utley, NBC News, Paris.
The controls in November, but we don't know when we'll ever get rid of them. Back in a minute. Phase two, it's called, the controls to be put on the economy after the 90 days are up. They're being worked out now at the White House and the Treasury. And while there are dozens of rumors and reports and speculations, we don't know yet exactly what form they will take. But here's another speculation, and it is that nobody can say exactly when the American economy will again be free of controls. Some of the more pessimistic critics even say they think we're moving into the end of free enterprise as we know it. Whether or not that is true, I do believe we're entering more and more into what you might call the bureaucratic state. Still about as free as we are, we hope, in terms of personal rights and liberties, but less so in terms of economics. If that is unsettling, one might consider the fact that economically we're not all that free now. Very substantial parts of the American economy are already under bureaucratic control and have been for quite a long time. All forms of mass transportation, nearly all forms of communication, the huge aerospace industry, all the utilities, telephones, electricity, gas, water, banks, savings and loans, insurance, the stock markets, exports and imports. The biggest industry, automobiles, increasingly is told by government what it has to put into its cars and what to leave out. Highway building, to some extent home construction, all of that and more lies to a greater or lesser degree within the grasp of the bureaucracy. When you add agriculture, as we must, it is a formidable list. So instead of saying we're moving into the bureaucratic state, it would be more accurate to say we're already in it. You can get an idea of how far we're in it by looking at the figures. One out of six people employed in this country is employed by government, and that ratio is rising rapidly. In recent years, one out of every three new jobs has been a government job, federal, state, or local. If that continues, it'll mean more and more people working for government and relatively fewer working in private areas and paying the taxes to support them. For comparison, in the U.S., it's one out of six on the government payroll. In Great Britain, it's one out of 18. In Japan, one out of 33. The more bureaucracy we have, we can take it for granted, the more rules and regulations we'll have, and the more interference with people's economic affairs. Some may find this acceptable and may think for the greatest good of the greatest number, that's how it has to be. Maybe so, but it's not the picture of this country we're accustomed to seeing. David Brinkley, NBC News, Washington.
On the plight of American cities came out today. One part of it says, if poor Negroes and Mexican Americans continue to be isolated in ghettos, most cities by 1980 will be predominantly black and brown and totally bankrupt. 1980. It is less than 9 years and counting to 1980. I'll have more on this report and issues in a minute.
On Chancellor.
The National Urban Coalition recently set up a task force called the Commission on the Cities in the 70s. The commission's job was to survey the major cities in the country to see what has taken place since the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders made its report, the Kerner Report, in 1968. The news is almost all bad. The report says housing is still the national scandal it was then. Schools are tedious and turbulent. Rates of crime, unemployment, and disease are higher. Heroin addiction is higher. Welfare rolls are larger. And with few exceptions, relations between the blacks, browns, and the police are just as hostile as in 1968. The report does say that the inner city residents of Atlanta, Detroit, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Newark, and El Paso are perhaps even angrier than they were 4 years ago, but that these people are banding together, speaking the language of brotherhood, and reaching for the levers of power. And the report says the state of mind on the streets is a cause for some hope. The co-chairmen of the report are Senator Fred Harris of Oklahoma and Mayor John Lindsay of New York, and the mention of their names will make some people immediately cry out, bleeding hearts, who would believe them? Well, a lot of people should believe them, for the judgments of this new report on the cities bear out all the evidence available. We are coming to the end of the time for reconciliation on the future of the cities. The population figures indicate that. Before long, perhaps by the end of the decade, the big cities will, in fact, be the domain of the blacks and the browns. And when that happens, the big cities will become pitiful, helpless, and very dangerous giants. It is not beyond imagination to see the country studded with angry city-states, with the dark-skinned people inside and the whites outside. Who is to say that toll gates won't be set up for commuters? The barriers are there now for the blacks trying to get out to the suburbs. There is no more desperate part of American life today than the destruction of our cities. Most of us ignore them, build roads around them, isolate the people in them, pay token taxes to keep them alive for a while longer, as they slip into a long, medieval night of poverty and wickedness. We have another report today which forecasts this awful future. But does anyone care? John Chancellor, NBC News, New York.
A populist candidate for president, it's interesting to see that old party's 19th century ideas still sound pretty good. But Senator Harris is running for president as a populist. A Democrat, yes, but running on a somewhat modernized version of the old populist party platform. It had its brief moments in the late 19th century when it ran a candidate for president named James B. Weaver, a red-hot reformer then. He got more than 1 million votes and carried 4 states. The populist party died for the same reasons other small parties have died in this country. One of the big parties lifted all of its ideas, ran on them, used them, and in the process killed off the small party. So it is interesting now to see at least the name and some of the ideas revived and offered again in our century. The original Populist Party was heavily agrarian in a day when the country was still more rural than urban. It also was union-oriented in a day when unions were small, weak, and scarce. One of the Populist's more radical demands was the 8-hour workday. And it was oriented to the South, the Midwest, and the West. Some of its main policies, the free coinage of silver and others, have no relevance today. But some of its ideas do, and some are still attractive to people who don't even know they are populist, or were. One of their demands, generally stated, was a government serving the people, as opposed to what we have now, a government demanding that the people serve it. If anyone doubts that is the case, he might try to think of any democratic country in history where the people had less to say about their own lives and their own country than we have in this country. The American people are constantly dictated to by a remote, unresponsive Washington establishment, always told, seldom asked, and when they are asked and when they say what they want, their wishes often are ignored. There is a constant growth in bureaucracy, rules and regulations, a constant growth in taxes to pay for it, a constant growth in government interference with the people's lives, but no equivalent growth in services or benefits. In short, the more government we get and are forced to pay for, the less we get in return. So it may not be surprising now that that particular populist view, opposing all of this, is still attractive. Oddly enough, it appeals to political activists on both the left and the right. It is doubtful the party itself will ever live again, but some of its ideas are very much alive and relevant. David Brinkley, NBC News, Washington.
Happened in London today boggles the mind. International espionage is a serious game played by professionals. The stakes are high, but the number of people involved is usually small. So what are we to make of the biggest breakup of an espionage organization in modern history? The British today threw out over 100 Russians who had been, in one way or another, spies. The size of this operation does boggle the mind, and it's worth looking at in some detail.
John Chancellor.
The Russians have more people in London than anywhere else in the West, including Washington. There are, or were, 550 Russians attached to their embassy, trade delegations, the Moscow Bank, until today, when the British threw out 105 of them because of espionage. It's the biggest bust of a spy organization which has taken place in modern times. A genuine, sensational development. The British have known that the Russians were spying, known it for a long time. Sir Alec Douglas Hume, the foreign minister, wrote Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko a letter about it in December of 1970. The letter was neither acknowledged nor answered. Another letter was sent last month. Again, no acknowledgement, no response. But about 3 months ago, one of the senior espionage officials in the Soviet Union defected to the British in what one London newspaper today calls a triumph for the British intelligence service. Here's how the Foreign Office described it today. Evidence of the scale and nature of Soviet espionage in Britain, conducted under the auspices of the Soviet embassy, trade delegations, and other organizations, has been provided by a Soviet official who recently applied for and was given permission to remain in this country. The Foreign Office statement continues. This man, an officer of the KGB, brought with him certain information and documents, including plans for the infiltration of agents for the purpose of sabotage. So says the Foreign Office, and the only thing left to say is, wow, what a story. That is the toughest language used by the staid old Foreign Office in many, many years. The KGB, as most readers of spy novels know, is the Committee for State Security in the Soviet Union. And evidently, the KGB has been running a string of agents in Britain as long as your arm. Among those being kicked out, 90 people are being kicked out, or not allowed to return to Britain, 15 more who are on vacation, are agents of the embassy, the in-tourist office, the Aeroflot airline office, the trade delegation, and the Moscow Narodny Bank. What a haul! If you wrote that story in a novel, it would be unbelievable.
but it happened today in London. John Chancellor, NBC News, New York.
Fair week again, but this does not refer to hammers, nails, and screwdrivers. Back in a minute.
David Brinkley.
It is again National Hardware Week, and it would be nice if we were talking about hammers and nails and screwdrivers. But no, it's military hardware, a commodity the American taxpayer is forced year after year to buy by the ton, thousands of tons, even though a lot of it never works, a lot of it is totally unnecessary, and a lot of it is so expensive it costs per pound twice as much as pure gold. And however much the taxpayers pay for and have been paying for 25 years, it's never enough. And so, National Hardware Week, the time when the Pentagon budget for buying new weapons is before Congress again. The amount asked this week, and this is not all of it, is $21 billion. And that's only for this year and only for the new stuff to be piled on top of the old stuff. Congress always argues, but so far it's always voted the money. This week, another chapter in this annual and highly expensive drama, Senator Humphrey says in a speech it is time to stop what he calls this international drama of wrong assessments and the lust for superiority. By wrong assessments, he refers to those times when Congress has been told the Russians are building some horrible new weapon, and so the Air Force or the Navy must immediately spend billions to counteract it. Well, this becomes sensational news and the money is voted. Later, when it turns out the assessment was wrong, that the Russians were not building the weapon described, then it's too late. The money is already committed. It is true, of course, this kind of information can never be totally reliable, that assessments made in good faith will sometimes be wrong, and so that is not really the point. The point is that whatever any other country builds, it is not necessary to match it or surpass it every time anyway. All that is necessary is for the U.S. to have enough military power to protect its own interests, period. Once that level is reached, any more military strength or hardware is superfluous and hideously wasteful. Once the country has the power to destroy any enemy that may threaten it, then there is no possible need for any more. And if all the money spent in 25 years hasn't bought that much, then it must be it cannot be bought. And if so, what do they hope to get this year by spending another $21 billion? Vice President Agnew says those trying to cut back on the hardware are following the communist line. Well, he must have got that out of Joe McCarthy's old bag of tricks. The fact is, President Nixon himself is trying to do this in the current talks with the Russians. But somehow Agnew didn't mention that. David Brinkley, NBC News, Washington.
Found that direct last Sunday, and said Dr. Strange can't never say again that he didn't have his face and head wiped off with a baby diaper. Because one of them said she had some clean diapers. She grabbed one of them and went to wiping his face. One of his back.
I don't know.
Susie just called me. She got a letter.
She did? What's the number of the apartment?
Four.
Four.
Apartment four. Yeah? She said she kept reading on down looking for the picture. She said, well, it must have lost out. And then she saw what you had at the bottom, you know.
Mm-hmm. She getting along all right?
Yes, and she's doing all right. She said she didn't call any of them. Finally knew he's called her. She said, well, I just made up my mind I won't go call anymore. And said Louise said Sulane and the baby was both sick. Sulane had missed nearly all week work. Of course. Of course, don't take no care of herself. Little old baby probably wouldn't have got it. Got it from her.
I guess she had him at her house.
And Susie said she was getting some kind of letter concerning the insurance that she had, and said she's supposed to pay that insurance every month.
Well, ain't she going to sit there?
Well, she said she had called and told her. She said, I got a notice here that the insurance wasn't paid. I'm going to pay it. I pay it. And she said, well, she hadn't paid it. Why didn't she pay it?
We better do something about that.
And so I don't know. Well, I don't know what she can do. But she said the woman got an apartment, said Beth there, that she just couldn't move. So she told us, said, well, You just have to get me another one, said, because I just can't do nothing right now.
That's too bad.
Yeah, well, it's plenty there. She said they'd be moving out anyway while they're coming, you know, to go in cheaper places.
Yeah. Well, I just...
Is JB going?
No.
I couldn't talk. Lynn, out yesterday in the night at Claire. You know, Nancy kept Miss Dedrick's children. They went to a funeral down to Sarasota. Some of his people died. Nancy kept the children there, so all up to the park. Me and Lynn went up to the park. And I venture to say that maybe she stayed up there with those children 10 minutes while we were there.
She took them and left?
Yeah. Says, come on, let's go, y'all.
Isn't that ridiculous?
It is. It beats anything. And little old Lynn was so happy to be up there, you know, where they all were. And she looked right cheap when they left.
Well, they'll do it every time.
Do it every blessed time. I never seen them be. And that little boy had some money. And he kept wanting to go to the store and buy him something. He said, Nancy, I want to go over to the store and buy me something. And she just turns and says to me, I don't want him going over to that old store spending his money. That's just what she said.
You ought to be ashamed.
Just exactly what she said. She didn't let him go. She never did let him go. Buying the BB or Mary Frances, whatever they call her, she come over there and bought a gallon of milk.
They sure do make me mad about Lynn, I guess.
Well, I don't know, but now you knew. I don't see why in the world if she couldn't have stayed there a little while and let that child visit with those children. There's Dina and Donna and Bibi and Lee. And they were all up there, you know.
Well, she took them all, I guess.
It just left, didn't leave nobody but me and Lynn. Took Dina and Donna home with her. And Lynn, I said, Nancy, can I come over to your house after Sunday school and see if I can find some worms? Said, we're going out to the lake after Sunday school.
What'd she say?
She didn't say nothing. She never even replied. But I heard that little Dedrick boy, he moved a box out there in my dog pen, and he said, I've never seen so many fishing worms in my life. I don't know whether they're still under there or not.
I better go.
Well, I just really don't think I got anything to weigh over there. So I just don't really think I'll go.
Well, okay, I thought maybe you might
want
to go hear a different sermon.
Maybe Miss Johnson
will
want to go ask her.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Hi, Mrs. Flagg.
Yes, Margaret.
This is Margaret.
Yeah?
Listen, I won.
Yes, I just heard.
You did?
Yeah.
Who called you?
Oh, Betty Keg.
Oh, she did. Well, see, at first I didn't win, and then they decided that I should win, so I won.
Well, fine.
I'm so glad. Gosh, I just learned just now, you know? I'm so happy.
Very good.